All right, nice to be with you on this Saturday night. Back up to the Bay Area, we bring in the third base coach of the San Francisco Giants, and that is the professor, Ron Wotus. Well, how are you?
Marty, I'm well. Enjoying this beautiful day here in the Bay Area on a Saturday night. So how about yourself? How things go this week for you?
Yeah, pretty good. I, as I said when I opened the show, I know now why they call this place the Valley of the Sun. Because we've got 99 to 100 every day. It's a little early, but you've managed down here, and you know, you've been part of a baseball scene down here, so you know what it's like. But I think we're going to see some action on the baseball front over the next couple of weeks. And as you've said, you know, if there is a spring training and a season, you have to make plans ahead of time. You just can't tell people just show up next week.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. Look, the country's opening up. Things are starting to move. We'll see, you know, what the fallout is from all this activity. But I know people are antsy. Everybody's antsy. I know MLB wants to get baseball on TV for the fans and give the country something, some sort of entertainment that for all the baseball fans that love it. And just in general, you know, I think a lot of people are clamoring to get things moving. So I think you said it correctly. I think we'll know something in the next couple weeks as things are starting to move.
You know, a part of doing the show, I love going back and looking at different situations. And, well, I want to tell you something. I'm going to give you a baseball situation. This is why you're the professor, and Bill is going to join us in just a few minutes. But let me throw this one at you. Last night I got to listen to the ninth inning of the 1960 World Series, game number 7, between the Pittsburgh Pirates and the New York Yankees. And, of course, we know how it ends. Bill Mazeroski hits a home run in the bottom of the ninth, and the Pirates win the World Series over the Yankees. But the top of the ninth inning was a real baseball inning for me, and we've never talked about this aspect of baseball. And I said, I got to talk to the professor about this. Yankees are down 9-8. It's in the top of the ninth inning. There's one out, and there's runners on first and third. And Mickey Mantle is on first, and Dale Long is on third. And who comes up with the number 4 hitter, the cleanup hitter, probably the best Yankee hitter of all, and that's Yogi Berra. And I said to myself, I'd never really listened to the inning so carefully to, you know, set it up and who's coming up. And I said, boy, Yankees are in good shape. And Berra proceeds to hit just a shot down the right field line. The first baseman, Rocky Nelson, spears it on the ground. Steps on first. Now, Dale Long takes off on the hit. Steps on first and goes to look to second, to throw to second for the tag play on Mantle. And Mantle doesn't go anywhere. He slides back into first base and is safe. And the Yankees tie the game 9-9. And I said to myself, God, that is a baseball moment of a base runner. Heads up, realizing that the force is off, and he went back to first base. And I'll tell you, well, I've watched baseball a long time. I can't think of too many times that that's happened that instinctively. Can you?
No, you're exactly right. That's a heck of a play by Mantle. And, you know, I don't know exactly where the ball was, et cetera, when it happened, but that's the risk that you take when you take that force away. Yeah. You know, because even if he threw to second and Mantle stops and now Mantle gets in a rundown, the run's still going to score before he gets tagged out. So if at all times, if you can, you know, do it as a force play on the double play of the position where the ball is hit and where you catch it, et cetera. But it's tempting when you're so close to the base, it is enticing to step on the base, but you better execute that rundown and you better hope that there's not a heads up base runner like Mantle was and get back to first base.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, of course, you think of, well, it was 9-9 and Mazeroski hit the home run. But, you know, to take it apart in that inning was interesting. And the inning before this, and you'll appreciate this, of course, Tony Kubek gets hit in the throat by a ground ball that's a double play ball. And it hits a pebble and hits him in the throat and he's knocked down and he's actually taken to the hospital. That's how hard he was hit. And the Pirates then proceed to score 4 or 5 runs, the last 3 coming on a home run by Hal Smith. Who's Hal Smith? The uncle of Tim Flannery. It's a 3-run homer that put the Pirates up 9-7. And it was the most important pebble involved in a World Series since it happened to the Giants in 1924 when a pebble went hit over the third baseman's head to cost them the World Series. But I guess the point being that you take apart these games and you look at the people involved, and there's just so much more to baseball than just the final score.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, I always tell you on this show that winning is so fleeting, and there's an example right there. We've seen a lot of crazy stuff with the Giants. You see Gold Glovers make an error that opened the floodgates. We talked about Atlanta's second baseman making multiple errors, balls between his legs to allow us, you know, to score the winning run and win a game. In this case, a pebble was the factor in one of the outcomes. So it's so fleeting. And I think you're right. I think, you know, baseball has these moments that you never forget. And that's why people love it so much. It's more than just the game itself. There's a lot of nuances that go on. And that's why people love the game of baseball.
Yeah, it is. It's so much fun to pull it apart. And as I say, you get that final score, but how you get there. Bill Lasky joins us. Bill, how are you this week? What's new?
Hey, good evening to you, Marty, and good evening to Ron, of course. And I hope you have the air conditioning on yourself, Marty, because when I hear over 90, I better have air conditioning on because I am not a Valley of the Sun kind of guy.
No, this is over 90. Is not 90. I'm you know, putting a coat on. You know, 90's fine.
But I do want to ask Ron something. I was eye spying on Twitter this week, and I caught a picture of you on a video stream, and behind your right shoulder was a World Series trophy. And I wanted to ask you, what year was it, and is that a legitimate World Series trophy?
Hey, Bill, how you doing? Thanks for the trophy question. I appreciate that. Well, I'll tell you, that is 2012, and on a coach's salary, that is not the legitimate World Series trophy. Where I got that was actually 2012, Boach sent everybody a gift. We got it right before Christmas. His big box came to the house, and I pulled this trophy out. And my goodness, it is the most gorgeous replica of the World Series trophy. Well, in the moment, I didn't know it was a replica until the next day when I talked to Mark Gardner, and he had to share with me that it was a replica. So I was quite impressed by getting the trophy. It looks great, and it's nice to have it.
Well, very good.
It looked great. It looked great on the video stream. I mean, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool how he's got it mounted on a nice display case behind you. And I was like, I have to ask him on Saturday if that's true. And now I got the answer.
Very, very thoughtful.
Yeah.
Very thoughtful. You know, it reminds me of, you know, the great Billy Pierce, who was, 12-0 at Candlestick in 1962. And, you know, was such a big part of the Giants winning the pennant, getting to the World Series. What the Giants did for him over the winter, like you, well, it was Christmas time, and, you know, FedEx, UPS, or whatever worked at that time came to the door with a big box, and they sent him the pitching rubber from Candlestick. That was his gift.
That's a big thing, too, Marty. That's pretty heavy because that goes deep into the wood and into the ground, and that's a big – I've seen those before. I've seen them when they put them in the ground, and those things are heavy as well as – they go deep because it has to be pretty sturdy, I guess.
Yeah, that was Billy Pierce's Christmas present. Yeah, I love this part of baseball. And, you know, watching a lot of baseball this week, a couple of things struck me that I felt I could talk to you guys about. One was they did a lot on Barry Larkin this week. And, we've never really talked much about him, Bill. We haven't talked about him that much as well. He is a Hall of Famer. And they kept comparing him to Derek Jeter. And Jeter, of course, is out of New York. And, you know, the great moments of diving into the stands and the home runs against Arizona in November and all the 3,000 hits. And, you know, they're just glorifying Jeter. And then all of a sudden I said to myself, you know, I think Larkin maybe was a better ball player. So I said, I'd throw it out to you guys. What do you remember about Barry Larkin?
Well, you know, Oh, yeah, okay, thanks, Bill. It's hard to compare. I don't have the stats here in front of me, but I think what really stands out to me is if you put Barry Larkin in New York and Derek Jeter played in Cincinnati, you'd probably have heard more about Barry Larkin because of all the winning that they did, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first thing. But I love Barry Larkin as a player. You know, I looked at his stats a little bit here. He played 19 years, and for 10 years he had over 20 stolen bases. And that's kind of one thing I really like about him. He was a complete ball player. He was an outstanding defender. I mean, gold glove caliber defender. But he could steal a base, and he could beat you with the bat. He wasn't just a field shortstop. He was a hitter. He could hit behind the runner. He could hit and run. I think one year he had close to 30 home runs, but he gave you a tough at bat. One stat that jumped out at me was 11 years as an all-star, but as a hitter, he ended up with 939 walks and 817 strikeouts. So he walked more in his career. He was an extremely tough at bat, and the analytical people would have loved him today because he got on base. But in a close game, he could beat you three ways.
Yeah, I'm gonna go back on that first point. You know, by switching Jeter and Larkin from Cincinnati, New York. That's the big stage. That's where a lot of these players get the big media people, New York, L.A., Chicago. And I'm with you, Ron, and I'm sure Marty, too. You know, Barry Larkin was a guy who played in Cincinnati. He wasn't part of the big red machine, even though they won a World Series. I think it was 90. He was a leader by example. He was that type of guy who played every game, every inning, never complained. And he did put numbers up in every category, from home runs, doubles, triples, RBIs, as you said, stolen bases. But he was that solid nucleus of that infield for the Reds when they did win that World Series. And I do believe he was captain of that club, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yeah, Bill, I think you're right, Bill, because that's the other thing. Like Jeter, I always had so much respect for Derek Jeter because he played the game hard. He played the game right. You know, in the press, in the media, he was always first class. And I kind of viewed Barry Larkin in the smaller media market. But I viewed him the same way, was a very classful guy and a great ball player.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and I'm glad that we're talking about, and whoa, very good research. I'm impressed. Good research on Barry Larkin. Because when he was elected to the Hall of Fame, was he a dead bang Hall of Famer? I mean, were people clamoring that Barry Larkin is a Hall of Famer? Because Jeter, somebody didn't vote for Jeter, and you know, they went nuts that he wasn't a unanimous Hall of Famer. I don't remember Larkin being said, boy, he is a Hall of Famer. But listening to both of you guys talk about him, I don't think there's any doubt about it that he's a Hall of Famer.
What do you think, Bill? I mean, did you remember the comments about Larkin when he was going in?
Yeah, well, I think one of the big things that everybody said was, did he have good enough numbers? And I'm looking for numbers like you are, Ron. And he's close to 200 home runs, 295 batting average. I mean, his numbers are all stellar numbers. But, again, I go back to that media part of being Cincinnati compared to New York. And a lot of people never watched the Reds until they won the World Series in 90. But, you know, I there's no doubt about it. Watching his career from mid-'80s to middle of maybe 2003, 2004, he was a stellar shortstop. Defensive-wise, he had quick hands. He was quick around the bag, and he made the obvious plays. And the other one, when he did have to make a quick play up the middle or a backhand, he was so stellar about getting to the ball and getting that quick release. That's what I remembered about him as a defensive player.
Very good. Well, I'm glad we touched on him because he's now I'm convinced. When I look at him now and think about it, Hall of Famer all the way. So you guys did a good job with that. Now let's look at the other end of the spectrum. If I say the words or the name to you, Doc Ellis, what is that? Does that bring up any images, Bill, the Doc Ellis?
I think the only thing I remember about Doc Ellis, didn't he take some kind of pill or ecstasy? Or I don't know what he took, and he went and threw a no-hitter or a shutout or something. Am I thinking of the same guy, Doc Ellis?
Yeah, that's the one. The story was that he thought he was going to pitch the next day, and and this is in the early 70s. He allegedly, the story is that he took LSD. And and he sort of lost a day, and he woke up the next day, and they said, by the way, you're pitching today. And he said, what? And he went out to the ballpark, and he was looking at the scoreboard with zeros and double zero. He couldn't focus on anything, and he went out and pitched a no-hitter against the Padres. So that's what he was that was the big story about him. But yesterday was a big deal, May 1st, and I said, I got to talk to you guys about this. He was a little bit of an oddball, obviously, mm-hmm. you know, with that kind of background. He didn't like the Cincinnati Reds. And if you remember in the early period of the 70s, the Big Red Machine was beating the Pirates. They knocked them out of the pennant. Johnny Bench hit a two-out home run to tie a game, and Bob Moose wild pitched a run in that cost the Pirates the pennant to the Reds. And Doc Ellis never liked the Reds. So he said on May 1st, 1974, that I'm going to hit every one of them. I'm going to start the game, and I'm going to hit Rose, which he did. And Joe Morgan says he's not going to hit me. Next pitch hit him right under the arm. Hit Dan Driesen. And then Tony Perez, he threw four at. And Perez was just running all over the box, and he walked to walk in a run. And then threw two balls to the next guy, and then they took him out. And Doc Ellis claimed, and he made a bet with Kurt Bavacqua, that he was going to hit everybody because he didn't like the Reds. And he actually did it. It's probably the craziest start in Major League history. How about that? Can you imagine that being part of something like that?
Well, no, I can't. I mean, both those stories, it tells you a little bit. You said he was a little bit of an oddball, that's for sure. But to be able to hit three people in a row and not get tossed out of the game on its own is something, or not have anybody go out to the mound to fight him is something of its a shocking thing as well. So I don't think you'll see that record ever broken. How about three guys in a row and tried to hit four and then finally was out of the game? Never heard that story, Marty. Very good story.
Yeah, it is a good story. And I knew he didn't like the Reds because back in there, it was always the Reds and the Pirates always battling and everything because I grew up in Ohio and those were the two National League teams that it seemed like a good rivalry and it was always a solid rivalry. And And you're absolutely right. Why didn't anybody go out after him after three guys get drilled? And they're probably more surprised on the Red side by going, he's really doing this. And then when he did it, they didn't have any kind of return. Like, well, what are we going to do now? He may hit four or five more guys.
Yep.
So that is a weird story. I'm going to look that one up, Marty. I got to read about that one.
Yeah, May 1st, 1974. So don't forget, he was a good pitcher. He pitched in the, of course, he pitched a no-hitter. He pitched in the 71 All-Star game. Remember Reggie Jackson hit the home run on the light tower? And Vita started that game the first time the two African-Americans had started the All-Star game as starting pitchers. And Reggie hit the home run, and you know that, Bill, at Tiger Stadium off the light tower.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember Vita talking about that All-Star game because he just started dropping names of who everybody in the lineup, and I was my mouth was wide open because he was – that was the first start I think he had in an All-Star game in Detroit. And I think Henry Aaron was in there. I think Henry hit a home run off of him in the first inning. I'd have to look at that up. But, I mean, there was some great lineups. When you start looking at all those All-Star teams and some of the players that represented both the National League and American League, you know, those are just names, Hall of Fame names. Probably three-quarters of the lineup were Hall of Famers.
Which brings me to Woe. Well, you've been part of All-Star games, at least four, I guess, right?
Three. I didn't go the year that we won in 2002. Dusty went to Chicago and took his staff from the Chicago Cubs. So I didn't go to that All-Star game, but I've been to three.
All right. So what about the All-Star game and the dramatic moments? What do you remember? You know, because it's a little bit in the past. You know, this is 2020. It's been a little bit of a while. And now we've had time to reflect on it. When you think back to the All-Star game, what comes to mind for you?
Well, I think what comes to mind is it's so different than the regular season. It really is an honor to be there. And the thing that I really enjoyed about it was just going through batting practice, being in the clubhouse, being able to talk to the other great players in the league and infielders and talk to them about baseball or, you know, why they do this or why they do that. You know, but when the game starts, and we were playing to win, but still, it's still an All-Star game, and you still want to try to fit everybody in there, which is a challenge in itself. its own, you know, trying to get everybody in the game and try to win an All-Star game. But it didn't have the same energy with the game on the line that it does, obviously, during a regular season or a playoff, because I still think it's an exhibition to let these players show their skills. But it's something to watch when you have the best players and you go away from it as a coach, you know, talking about, hey, did you see how Kershaw warmed up in the bullpen? Or, you know, you talk to Billy Hayes, the catcher, he goes, wow, his stuff, his ball moves like crazy. You know, the little things you find out about the guys when you're actually working with them or being around them is the fun part for me.
How about Bill?
You know, Ron, I want to ask Ron a couple questions because this is a great, great selection of a question here, Marty, about All-Star games. And I know a lot of fans don't know a new coaching staff like Bruce Bochy and you guys come in from the Giants. What kind of preparation do you tell the players? Do you go over new signs? Do you go over anything like you're going to play the first two innings? Is there preparation and explanation to these guys by Bruce Bochy and your coaching staff? And when does that all happen? Do you do it, you know, during batting practice, after batting practice? Do you have meetings before the game? How does that all work?
Yeah, it's, you know, it happens before the game. You know, we'll have a quick meeting, obviously, to welcome everybody there. Boach will talk and introduce the staff. And then, you know, the third base coach, Flan, would go over a couple basic signs. And, you know, basically you're telling them, look, you guys are the all-stars. We're just here to push this thing along. But we need a couple signs. You know, if we have to run a bunt play, which I doubt we will, we'll just do it a standard bunt play. Flan may go over, you know, you're on your own sign. And they're all on their own anyways. I mean, the managers are letting these guys do their thing, but he does want to have a red light if he doesn't want anybody running. So there's a couple, you know, maybe two signs you put in there just so you can manage the game as a manager, but it's really on the players' backs on what they're going to do. And to your point, we as a coaching staff try to alert them when they're going in. You know, as a bench coach, I would say, you know, tell the guys on the bench, hey, you know, he's planning to go three innings, be ready to go in the fourth, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, you just manage it like a regular game. And but you do want to give these guys some sort of heads up whenever you can, and that's the way we ran it.
Anybody surprise you? You know, the same that you hadn't met before and say, you know, wow, what an unusual guy?
Probably so. You know, going the three of them, you you know, I won't mention the name, but I remember a couple guys left when they got out of the game. I heard they were long gone. So sometimes you get some things that you go, wow, I never would have expected that. But, you know, hey, the game's there for them. They're out of the game. And that surprised me a little bit, but nothing too off the wall to where I was really surprised by a guy. But I will say this briefly. One guy that really I was really impressed with was DJ LeMahieu. Because he prepared for the All-Star game just like he did if he was playing in the seventh game of the World Series. And, you know, that always stuck with me. I said, you know, this guy's going to be a good player. He took his ground balls. He was serious. He approached it like a regular game. And I thought to myself, you know, you got all guys all over the spectrum. Some guys are just, you know, having a good time. They're really not taking a ground ball. But he approached it a little differently. And look at the players he's become. So that stuck with me seeing that with him.
Well, you've always liked him, Woe. You've always liked LeMahieu. Remember, we talked about second baseman. He was one of your favorites.
Yeah, he puts the ball in play. You know, he's got a good idea of the strike zone. He could hit the ball the other way. And I've always believed if you could hit the ball the other way, and Bill can attest to this, it's much harder to get the guy out three times in a row pitching inside. I mean, he can be vulnerable inside, but if he can stay on that breaking ball and handle that ball away, it's harder to get guys out in. It can be more dangerous, too. But I always liked his skills and the way he approached the game. Mm.
You know, Ron, when you went to your first All-Star game, you know, both as players and now as a coach, you always look at certain players and go, wow, I'd love to meet him, or he was, you know, just a delight to watch and play, and now I see him right on the same field. Was there an American League player that you were like, wow, I'd like to meet him or look at him and watch him a little bit more? Was there somebody like that that, you know, you kept your eyes on and you were like, wow, that's him, you know, because I know there's always an awe in player versus player.
Yeah, Bill, I think you're right. I think that, you know, that's part of the joy and the honor of going to the All-Star game. And, you know, you get to rub elbows with the National League players, but you really, really didn't get to rub elbows with the American League players, you know, and you're looking at them across the field. You know, you might see somebody in BP or something like that. But, you know, all the great American League players. And I didn't have an opportunity really to talk to many of them, but I always was impressed with, you know, Mariano Rivera and some of the great American League players that we don't get to see on a regular basis. Right. So it's fun to be able to watch them in that All-Star game, all of them on the field at the same time.
Yeah. You said Ruben Rivera. Wasn't he the base runner?
Yeah, he's the greatest base runner in the history of the game, if you remember. Giants.
You opened the door. You opened the door. You might as well tell the story.
I don't know if I can even give the details for how many mistakes that he made. I mean, the ball was hit in the outfield. He took off. He went past second. Then he thought the ball was caught. He retreated, didn't retouch second, cut across the diamond, but the ball wasn't caught. So he had to take off again, touch second, go around third. I think there was an error, and he tried to score, and he was thrown out at home plate. But if you Google Ruben Rivera and the Giants, Felipe Alou is the manager, it's going to be one of the most intriguing and interesting base running moves you've ever seen in your life. It went on for about 30 seconds.
I remember that too. It was just intriguing to watch it. You're like, where's it going? What's he doing? It was really, he didn't have a clue, but it worked out.
How do you like working with Felipe? Because we don't talk enough about Felipe. You know, he has his sayings. You know, you've always, you know, dropped a few of his sayings on the show. But what was it like really working with him?
Oh, he's a treasure. I mean, he's a jewel. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, I mean, all the knowledge, all the games that he has seen, and the thing that I really enjoyed is he liked to share that with you. And I think I've told you before on the show that he was a talker in the dugout. He'd talk about situations. He'd talk about the game. And as a bench coach, it's nice to have that communication back and forth and be engaged in the moment like that, opposed to, you know, not hearing anything and then giving your opinion. But the other thing that I really enjoyed with him is he came in after the games all the time. And he'd come into the coach's room, and he'd sit there and he'd hold court. He'd open his wine, and that's where I found my love for red wine, because we drank enough of it. And he'd go over the situations and of the game and relive certain things, and you really got to understand who this man was. He's so passionate about the game. I mean, it's who he is. And, you know, when he's done during the regular baseball season, he's over in a Dominican watching games because he just loves it so much. What an amazing man. What an amazing baseball man.
Hmm. You know, talking to him, his communication, once he knew who you were and the knowledge that you had in the game of baseball, it was just like sitting down to two best friends. He always had that glee. He always had that humor. He always had the style of Felipe. And he would sit and chat with you about anything and talk about an interview here or a situation that came about. I remember doing that so many times with him. And Billy, come on in. Bill, come on in. You know, talk to me, you know. And I'd sit in there 10, 15 minutes, and people would want to come talk to him. And he's like, oh, they'll wait. I want to talk to you more. And he was always open door like that. And I never played for him. I played against him, of course. But, boy, he was just a very warm and helpful person. And like you said, Ron, the education and the knowledge of him is way far more than a lot of the Latin coaches and a lot of the Latin managers that have played the game.
Well, I've said it before on the show that he's, in my opinion, he's the most influential Latin player that's ever played Major League Baseball, been part of Major League Baseball. Not taking anything away from Clemente and the great player he was and tragically dying, but what Felipe did for the Latin player and the Latin Bill of Rights for the players and what he went through in the 60s with Alvin Dark and the Giants, there's nobody like Felipe, and I think he's the guy that should, if they're going to retire a number, they ought to retire his number if they want to honor a Latin player. So that's how I feel about him.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a question. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask Marty. Marty, when the Lous played together with the Giants, I know you remember these days. which Alou brother was better than each other?
Well, Felipe, well, you probably have had discussions with Mays and other people about it, but Mays always told me that Felipe was the second best outfielder on the team. And, of course, you know who the best was. His birthday is May 6th. But Felipe was the second best player, you know, outfielder on the team. Jesus Alou was a hitter, and he wasn't a great fielder. But what I remember, he always used to roll his neck and had all sorts of stretching things when he'd get in the box.
Yeah.
But he was more like Pablo in many ways. You know, he never saw a pitch he didn't like. And he was just a tremendous hitter and outfielder. And Matty was a sort of a slap hitter. And when he was traded to Pittsburgh, Harry Walker was the manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And Harry Walker was famous for teaching you how to hit down on the ball. And, of course, Pittsburgh at that time had artificial turf. And Matty Alou became a batting champion under Harry Walker because he would choke up and he would just slap the ball and just punch the ball. So Felipe was the best. Matty was probably the most accomplished hitter for hitting all field. And Jesus Alou was just, give me the bat and show me where the plate is, and I'll go from there. But Ken, remember Ken Forsch? Remember the pitcher?
Yeah.
Ken Forsch,
right-hand pitcher.
Remember him? So Harry Walker was the manager of the Houston Astros, and of course he was teaching the pitchers how to hit, and his whole thing was to choke up as far as you could on the bat, even for the pitchers. So he would do that with Ken Forsch, and Ken Forsch said he had a choke up so far on the bat that he hurt his ribs. He couldn't swing. That was Harry Walker. He just he wanted you to choke. Remember Harry Walker? Well, was he part of Pittsburgh ever?
No, but I know what you're talking about, choking up like that. You know, they try to get me to choke up more because I wasn't making enough contact, and you can't choke up that far on a bat, right? You got to be careful there.
Yeah, no.
And I tell you what, Ron, there isn't too many players now in the current day that choke up. You might see maybe a half an inch off the knob. I don't see too many people choking up.
No, they don't. You're exactly right, Bill. That's isn't that something that people don't choke up on the back? You know, on the bat, the contact isn't as important. You know, it's the all or nothing type swing, even with two strikes. I mean, everybody wants some work in the count and getting on base, but you know, you see a lot of people's opinions will live with some strikeouts as long as they get some home runs. So yeah, it's changed quite a bit.
Yeah, that was Harry Walker. He made Matty a batting champion by having him choke up and hit down on the ball. So that was that's the answer to that one. Here's one that came up this week. It was a good one. We had the anniversary of Nolan Ryan's seventh no-hitter. And the question was put out there by somebody who said, well, what's more impressive, seven no-hitters by Nolan Ryan or 12 one-hitters by Bob Feller? Bill, you're the pitcher. I'll let you answer that one.
Well, I'm going no hitters because I never had one. And I'll tell you what, I've had a handful of one hitters, and that no hitter is just something that is so difficult to do. And for Nolan Ryan to do that and seven times is phenomenal. Of course, he was phenomenal. I got to face him a couple of times. I got in his 3,000 strikeout book, which said Bill Askey won, because I tried to bunt and he threw me three curveballs that I never even fouled one off. He was just phenomenal on the mound. He was a guy that you just watched, and he was that you know, big star back in the days in the 70s and the 80s, and everybody wanted a piece of him. But I still think the no-hitter, Marty and Ron, is the ultimate for any pitcher to have.
Yeah, Bill, I'm not going to argue with the pitching guy. I mean, he lived it. He's on that mound. He knows how difficult it is to give up, you know, one hit in the game. And, you know, 12 one-hitters is impressive. I don't know how many one-hitters Nolan Ryan had, but, you know, the no-hitter for me takes the cake, even though there's only 7 to 12. But I'd like to know how many one-hitters Nolan Ryan had. I bet you he had 7 or 8 himself.
Yeah, well, we could look that up. Someone can look that one up and find. That's actually a good question. Feller had one. Did he have 3 no hitters? I think 3. I could be wrong. I think he had 3 no hitters as well. But 7. Yeah, I guess the number of 7 is just incredible. to be able to shut down a team like that. But, you know, Nolan Ryan was, and, well, you know this, you know, you remember him. If you got a hit off of him, well, look what Will Clark did. You know, how about Will Clark? His first at bat hits a home run off Nolan Ryan. What about that?
Yeah, no, that's impressive. I mean, you were there, Bill?
Wow. Yeah, I was in the dugout. I was on that roster. That was amazing. Everybody, and you hear Kruko talk about it all the time, everybody was on the top step because he came into spring training, and everybody was like, who is this guy? And he just kept backing it up every time. And when he hit the home run, I was maybe 2 feet, 3 feet away from him. He always tells the story. He sat next to Chili Davis and said, what should I expect next? And Chili goes, he's going to hit you. Just like that.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing it and seeing it, and Will's mouth was wide open. And Will tells the story, next time up, the first pitch, he backed out because he thought for sure he was going to get drilled. But that's the way Bob Gibson was. That's the way all the top-line pitchers were. You hit me, I'm going to drill you the next time to tell you don't get, you know, concrete in those shoes because I'm going to make you move. And that ball Will hit went out straightaway center field in the dome. And I know Ron and Marty, you both, it was hard to hit a ball out of straight center field in that ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you play there, Will? Yeah, you played in the Astrodome?
No, I didn't play in the Astrodome. Yes, I did. And I actually coached there one series, too. In 1991, I was managing the San Jose Giants. And in September, as a coach, I got a September call-up to the Major League Club. Don't ask me how this happened, but I got a September call-up as a coach, and I traveled the last month of the season with Roger Craig and Bob Lillis and the whole gang. And I remember being in Houston and with the guys. So, that's a big orchard, no doubt about it. You really have to hit it to get it out of there.
What was it like being with Roger Craig?
You know, they were real nice. You know, Roger was really big into the release times with the pitchers. You know, he was known for, you know, the pitch out and getting the pitchers to be quicker to the plate, controlling the running game. Everything was in a science at times. And I used to sit there with Bob Lillis, and they'd give me a stopwatch and say, hey, if, you know, keep track of these times for us. If you got anything to add, if you think we should pitch out, speak up. So they were really good to me, you know, which they had no business doing that at that point in time. Here I am an A-ball, but they treated me with a lot of respect, and it was a great education for me to be there at that point in time and to be able to be around them.
Did he say hum baby a lot?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he did. Huh, Bill? Bill knows that. He liked saying hum
baby. I played for him, but I tell you, a guy's name that never gets a lot of respect is Bob Lillis. That guy was just a human encyclopedia about every player, every move you could make. He should have been big-time manager for many years, and he was always that second guy that never got a chance. I guess we know who that a comparable person like that, Ron. But Bob Lillis was
another Giants coach,
that
huh?
Yeah, and Bob Lillis, and you know, Ron, he was stellar with all the knowledge he could put out there. And, of course, he was with the Astros for many years, and he came over here. But he was a guy that could sit down, and you could go and have a conversation about any hitter. What do you think I should throw? And he would tell you, and that's what I loved about him. And he was that guy that never got an opportunity. And like I said, Ron, I mean, that's the Bob Lillis, the Ron Wotus parallel.
You remember his nickname?
Flea. He's the Flea.
That's right, the Flea.
Yeah. He, you know, all the players really loved him and respected him. You know, I talked to Robbie Thompson and of course, Will Clark and all these guys, and they all love Flea. I mean, he was the glue that held those guys together in that infield. They had such a great infield with Uribe and Thompson and Clark and Matt Williams. My goodness, he was a great infield coach, and you're right, Bill. He offered so much to that ball club, and just stayed in the shadows and wasn't in the limelight, but he was a big part of what happened there in San Francisco.
Bill, when Frank Robinson managed the Giants, who were his coaches then? Who was with
Bob
Frank?
Miller. Bob Miller was a pitching coach. Don Buford was the first base coach. I'm going to continue. I think Dabby was our third base coach at that time.
Okay.
I might be wrong there. I'd have to remember on that one. But I remember Bob Miller being my pitching coach. Or no, Don McMahon was the pitching coach. Bob Miller came on with Dabby after when he was manager. So it was Frank Robinson. He was a man. I mean, everybody, when he spoke, everybody listened. There wasn't too many people that spoke of anything around him. Frank led the pack in everything, every meeting, every coach's meeting, every pitcher's meeting. Frank was the guy telling you what to do, and everybody just kind of followed suit. But Don Buford was his right-hand man, and Don McMahon was one of my best pitching coaches. He was stellar in all the education he brought on, and he always stuck up for his pitchers. That's what I loved about him.
Mm, very good. Hey, let's take a break. I have a couple of things. You guys are great. It's like, you know, going, for me, it's like going to college to hear your opinions on all this kind of stuff. By the way, Sam Spear has texted me, and Sam says that Nolan Ryan had 12 one-hitters.
Oh. Wow. There you go.
That's
good
amazing.
Work, Sam. Good work.
Got it, baby, Sam.
If Sam is, that's the same as unbelievable. That means 12 one-hitters and 7 no-hitters.
Yeah.
Wow.
There you go.
Pretty impressive right there.
All right, a couple of things. One, I got to watch Tom Seaver's 300th win this week on TV. It was terrific with the White Sox. And I want to tell you, he had nothing. And somehow Carlton Fisk got him through this game, and La Russa left him in there for the whole 9 innings in Yankee Stadium. And it was such a dramatic moment of the 52,000 in New York screaming for Seaver, and he wins the game 4-1 over the Yankees. And it made me think about drama and the drama of baseball. And I was going to ask you guys the most dramatic moments that you've been involved with in baseball, dramatic moments. Because this Seaver thing, I said, boy, I really miss baseball. I really miss the game and the way it ends up with all the drama. So I ask you that. And the other thing is, today is the anniversary of the day that Lou Gehrig took himself out of the lineup after 2,130 straight games of playing. And when I grew up, that was a record to me. I said, no one is ever going to break that record. It's just not going to happen. And, of course, Cal Ripken breaks the record. So I was going to ask you guys, is there a record that you thought about that would never be broken that got broken? And I'll throw that to you. So you guys can contemplate that. We'll take a break. Come back with Ron Wotus and Bill Lasky right after this.